how you want your grinding done. And I want it fixed up, baby, just like your daddy done. And I ain't gonna talk no more. And oh, baby, ain't gonna talk no more. Since you told me you want it fixed, baby, just like my daddy done. Many nights I ramble and I stay down the whole night long. Many nights I ramble, stay down the whole night long. Trying to teach my woman how to do right from wrong.
Had to have my fun. WRCT Pittsburgh. It's more fun when it doesn't make any sense.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.
I'm Andrew Saul, Commissioner of Social Security. Beware of telephone scammers pretending to be government employees. Real Social Security employees will never threaten you. Callers threatening you with arrest or other legal action and demanding money are not from us. If you receive a call like this, hang up. Do not provide them with any form of payment or information. Report the call at oig.ssa.gov.
Hi, this is God. Whenever I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent, I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT.
So we could think I'm straight, why can't I tell the truth? Plain J. Cole back then with a clear end goal. Like it all made sense, I needed myself and nobody else. Okay, let's go. From how it looks, man, it's hard to complain. And I just been praying that when I get older, that I got some smile in me that can remain. My money is long, but I got some new wishes. I feel like as long as they got my names, man, all I can wish is the mask that I wear and the faces below it is looking the same. Like,
oh, you've been in this fight, I can see it in your eyes. Like, oh, I made up my mind, I don't wanna waste no time, yeah.
Money making, while we're breaking, it's amazing, California. So celebrated or paraded. It's been faded. California, Maria's, the hills were swarming with dead ends and the bots performing. Don't mistake it, you can break big till you get sick.
About Zelensky One day he wants negotiations, and the next day he seeks more weapons. And NATO, which Zelensky has many times said, we don't need to be in NATO, understanding that this was always the kind of jujitsu strangeness. They couldn't even join NATO if they were invited to join NATO right now because of the territorial difficulties inside Ukraine.
That's Katrina Vandenhoevel, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Katrina Vandenhoevel on Russia, Ukraine, the war, and the United States. The Russian invasion of Ukraine, with its horrific atrocities and massive refugee crisis, has turned the world upside down. The war will have a huge impact on global food security, as both countries are major exporters of wheat, barley, and other grains. As usual, the media provide very little context and background. We're told ad nauseum that the Russian invasion was unprovoked. A careful look at history reveals a slightly more nuanced picture. To explain is not to excuse Moscow's criminal attack. Meanwhile, as two-time legendary Medal of Honor winner Marine General Smedley Butler reminds us, war is a racket. U.S. weapons corporations are lining up to feed at the trough. Before the war is over, many Ukrainians and Russians will die, while Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, and Northrop Grumman will make money hand over fist. Our guest today is Katrina Vandenhoevel. She's the editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine. She writes a weekly column for The Washington Post and has edited or co-edited such books as The Change I Believe In and Voices of Glasnost. I talked with her on April 11th. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, David.
Well, clearly the war, the Russian invasion of the Ukraine dominates the media pundits and the politicos in Washington, Moscow, and throughout Europe. But before we get into the actual war itself, talk about the history of these two nations, Russia and the Ukraine, and how they've been intertwined, not just geographically, but culturally. Their languages, Russian, you're a Russian speaker, and Ukrainian are very close. So someone told me it was like a Spanish and Portuguese in terms of being similar. So talk about that background of the between the two countries.
Thank you for beginning with history. I followed Russia over many years, 40 years plus, and the U.S.-Russian relationship. In terms of Ukraine, what I do know is that every Russian I have known over these last years has a relative of some kind in Ukraine. The intertwining of families, of relationships, to some extent culture, has been deep. And there's a sense of a Slavic brother, Russia, Ukraine, to some extent Belarus. Part of the conflict that we witness has such deep history, we can talk about that. But there is a sense, without demeaning Ukraine's independence and sovereignty, of a civil war inside Ukraine. That had to do with linguistic rights. One of the first things that happened in 2014 was the abolition of Russian language use in the eastern part. So there's been a kind of civil war between the East and the West over the years that has become a proxy war in some measure. Because I don't think you can talk about the Ukraine crisis right now without calling it a Ukraine-Russia-US-NATO crisis. But Ukraine has a deep history, complicated history. I mean, so much of that terrain has been defined by a war, World War II, that, you know, killed 27 million people, Soviets, which we know so little about. But we do know the East-West confrontation over Ukraine is now the epicenter of not a new Cold War anymore, David. It's a hot war.
Just to back up even a little bit before World War II, which when Germany invaded the Soviet Union and took tremendous destruction in Ukraine. Prior to that, in the early 30s, there was a great famine in Ukraine in which Millions of Ukrainians died, and it's known by them as the Holodomor. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Murder by hunger, and according to the Guardian Weekly, was consistently referred to as a deliberate act by Stalin to destroy the Ukrainian nation.
There's a lot of discussion and debate in the scholarly community about whether it was targeted at Ukraine or whether it was simply part of Stalin's brutal campaign to attack the kulaks. And the killing of Russians, of Ukrainians, was sometimes seen as there were so many killed by Stalin. Now, Steve, my late husband, wrote a book called The Victim's Return. And we have been involved with a Gulag museum in Moscow, which marks the Ukrainian famine. But what it does is bring different points of view to bear. But the Stalin Gulag and the issue of how many Stalin killed is a broad question. The question of whether it was targeting, the collectivization, which was part of his policy, was brutal unto itself.
A little fast forward to February 1989. The last Soviet troops withdraw from Afghanistan. November 9th of that same year, 1989, the Berlin Wall falls. 2 years later, the USSR dissolves. The country's leader, Gorbachev, and his foreign minister, Shevardnadze, negotiated with the then H.W. Bush administration and its Secretary of State, James Baker. It is during these negotiations that an offer was made to Moscow because of its security concerns, that NATO would not move, I'm quoting here, 1 inch to the east. Now, you have looked at the veracity of this comment. Is it documented?
It is documented. It is documented in the National Security Archives, a nonprofit group in Washington, D.C., which received the files and documents from those who were around Gorbachev, including Gorbachev's files, but a man named Chernyayev and others. Several books have been written with documentation, primary documents. What's so tragic, David, is if one believes in alternatives that could have brought more security, the opportunity at the end of the Cold War, at the end of the Soviet Union, to have a non-military alliance in Europe was a real possibility. The Soviet Union ended. Its counterpart to NATO, the Warsaw Pact, was dissolved. And instead of a vision Gorbachev had of a kind of transatlantic European home, from stretching from Vladivostok to Lisbon, NATO. And NATO was at first a few countries, but then it moved quickly, particularly in 2008 when Ukraine and Georgia were offered fast track. But this is one of the most tragic, perilous alternative steps that did not need to be taken. And for a brief moment, people were signed on to an alternative. I think James Baker needs much more scrutiny because he seems to have played a central role. You know, there's the famous interview with an esteemed diplomat, George Kennan, in 1997, who said this will be one of the grave mistakes. It will lead to new Cold War, to relationship between Russia and the United States fraught with militarization. And it has come to pass. And one takes no joy in feeling that one saw the possibility of this. So decades later, you had NATO on Russia's borders. It wasn't not 1 inch eastward. I also think people forget how significant it was. You talked about Afghanistan. Steve and I were in the Soviet Union when the troops came home. That was a very contested decision inside the Russian Soviet government. So you have that, and then you have a sense of betrayal on the part of the Soviet government that you had the NATO expansion later. Gorbachev, who is 91 in Moscow in a clinic, was one of the great visionary leaders. He is more respected at home today than he has been. The danger, the sadness is he's linked with Yeltsin. And that history hasn't gone that well.
So in your view, a great opportunity rapprochement.
More than rapprochement, a different approach to the world. You have militarization, you have a militarism of foreign relations today across the globe. 40, 50 years ago, you remember Olof Palme, you remember Willy Brandt. But an idea that human security, which today seems very relevant, climate, pandemic, nuclear proliferation, global inequality, poverty, these are the challenges and crises of our time, which military might is not well suited to deal with. And so on offer was an alternative way of engaging and shaping a world. It now seems so far away. And we've seen the costs of NATO expansion quite brutally, because I do think, though there are other factors, that NATO has played a role in what we see in the brutality in Ukraine.
You mentioned George Kennan, the much revered and venerated State Department diplomat. In that same statement that he made in 1997, he said, expanding NATO, I'm quoting here, such a decision may be expected to inflame the nationalistic, anti-Western, and militaristic tendencies in Russian opinion, to have an adverse effect on the development of Russian democracy, and to restore the atmosphere of the Cold War to East-West relations, and to impel Russian foreign policy in directions decidedly not to our liking. And that indeed has come to pass. And it's not like Kennan was some, you know, radical thinker. You know,
he was Mr. X, who had written about the need to contain the Soviet Union. He was quite sober. He was considered a realist.
Then you have also Clinton's defense secretary weighing in on NATO expansion. Again, not a radical leftist by any means. Bill Perry, in 2016, he said, in the last few years, most of the blame can be pointed at the actions that Putin has taken. But, he said, in the early years, I have to say the United States deserves much of the blame. Our first action that really set us off in a bad direction was when NATO started to expand, bringing in Eastern European nations. He said, Russia was, quote, very uncomfortable about having NATO right up to their border, and they made a strong appeal for us not to go ahead with that.
There were many appeals repudiated. I have to say, when I think of Bill Perry, you're right, no radical. But there's an expression in Russia, you know, when you go on pension, you become a dissident. And I mean, you know, he's kind of in that mode. And not only is he quite prescient in terms of his understanding of the danger of NATO expansion, but he's also been very wise about nuclear issues, which again needs to be brought into this discussion. But he's really continued, prior to an awareness, it seems to me, of nuclear peril in these last years, to sound the alarm. There's also someone else, no radical, the head of the CIA, William Burns, who very clearly came back from Washington. I think he was then the ambassador in 2008, and warned Washington, the establishment, that NATO expansion was not simply a Putin obsession, but across the political spectrum in Russia, it was very dangerous to expand. So there were many warnings. There were many warnings about the possibility and the need to define a different policy. But you know, David, when policies get invested and vested in DC, it's not simply the president, nor is it his advisors, but it's, you know, Ray McGovern, I don't know if you know him, but Mickey Matt, it's not simply, and I don't believe it's simply the military-industrial complex, but you also have the media, you have Congress, you have think tanks, you have a whole array invested in this policy, so it becomes very difficult to turn it around. It was easier at a different point, but, you know, the warnings were there. I will say, however, and I don't want to jump ahead, but February 24, Steve no longer here, but I've worked with many people who've studied the Soviet Union and Russia for 50 years, in shock that Russia went into Ukraine. And I think there was, even among those who've advocated for an alternative policy, there was not a sense of how far it had gone. Could I just say one thing? One of the reasons there was shock, and there's legitimate, more than legitimate shock. But David, we have not had a debate in this country in the last decade. It's been one hand clapping I mean, I'm not saying people have to agree with me, but you do need to have a range of views or certainly a debate. And that to some extent has been shut down. Your program, The Nation, there are different points of view, but the narrative, the dominant narrative, has been anti-Russian, Russophobia, and a misunderstanding that a country is not just one leader.
Now, talk about what is talked about in the media quite a bit, and that is Russia annexing Crimea in 2014, reversing a 1954 Khrushchev decision to transfer Crimea, which was part of Russia, to Ukraine. And of course, Putin has reversed that and has annexed Crimea. What's going on there and in the Donbas area, the Donetsk and Luhansk, these two, this large region with these two, what, sub-regions within them, Luhansk and Donetsk?
So Donbas is the region, and Russia has had people in there fighting. The eastern part of Ukraine has traditionally been Russian-speaking. It's been the heavy manufacturing, it's the factories, it's the miners. So when the protests started, made Maidan, there was a new leader in Kyiv. They began to fight those in the Donbas, Ukrainians, and mounted an anti-terrorist operation in 2014, which wasn't conducive to any negotiated settlement of the two regions. You did have the Minsk Accord, which has been the primary settlement document. But this is still contested. There will have to be, if there is, and there needs to be a settlement at some point, a way of resolving independence, sovereignty for Ukraine, but also linguistic rights and other things for the Donbas. Crimea, as you said, was gifted by Khrushchev in 54. It was part of the protests again in 2014, when if you listen to the Russians, they were fearful NATO was going to go into Crimea. They seized Crimea, annexed it, and that is interestingly not on the table right now, even in the Minsk agreements. Crimea has sort of been shelved for future work, because there are other annexation issues, as you know, in Yugoslavia, Western Sahara, others that some people like Anatole Levin, the scholar, believe should be part of a global kind of referendum, maybe monitored through the UN. That may be fantasy. But at the moment, some of the fighting going on, David, by the Russians in the East is designed to bring a bridge to Crimea and water. Because one of the issues in Crimea, as far as I follow it, is the water shortages, because Ukraine has had access and cut off water. Where that is resolved right now, it's not central, it seems, in the negotiations such as they are. And there have been, gets harder and harder, as you can imagine, as the brutality, the war crimes, but there are negotiations underway. And the longer the war goes on, the more dangerous the escalation, more lives lost, but it's a lot of weapons coming in.
Edward Said, the great Middle Eastern expert and scholar, talked about unresolved geographies.
David, there is the expression frozen conflicts. There are quite a few frozen conflicts, like Abkhazia, that region.
Well, you have, you know, current warfare between Azerbaijan and Armenia over Nagorno-Karabakh, one of the unresolved geographical ethnic issues. When a great empire collapses, there's all of this detritus around that is unsettled and unsettling.
The issue of empire is interesting. I will post it, but Steve did a very scholarly project about 10 years ago on how the Soviet Union ended, and he went through 10 theories. It ended with something he never liked, which was that the men make history, that Yeltsin had a will to power, Gorbachev had a will to reform, and they clashed on the scene. And Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia went into a forest in the Belovezh forest and signed a treaty ending the Soviet Union. But, you know, I was going to say I've covered Russia for 40 years. You can't cover a country by focusing on one person. Putin is Russia, but so is the Russian Orthodox Church. So are the regions. So are the regional governors. So is the right wing. So is there a tiny left wing? But the idea of covering a country as if Putin was the only, though I think if he's ousted, you will see a military security troika, you will not see Alexei Navalny in power. And that's a measure of the nationalism that arises in times of war and the militarization.
And of course, what happens in 2014, not just the annexation of Crimea, as you alluded to, the Maidan uprising and the ousting of Viktor Yanukovych, who was close to Moscow. It's been described as a coup. What exactly happened?
Viktor Yanukovych, by the way, Ukraine is deeply corrupt. So you get this offer to Ukraine, Yanukovych, of joining the kind of European Union. And in that offer is small kind of tiny language about also becoming part of a military union. The Russians put on offer the Eurasian Union. And at one moment, there was discussion of Yanukovych, Ukraine joining both, so that it would be a bridge between East and West and not one or the other. So then you have the Maidan protests. Yanukovych is essentially ousted. There is an agreement, briefly, Germany, France, US, to have elections, emergency elections, few months out. That is essentially moot.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Real vinyl.
Hello, Pittsburgh. You're tuned in to 88.3 FM, your favorite radio station. And this is the show to give a human name, probably your least favorite show on this station. But you're going to listen anyway. Up first, though, the radio music calendar, things going on around town. I'm going to start off with Miller Institute for Contemporary Art. The Miller Institute for Contemporary Art presents Dara Birnbaum, Journey, a survey of her interrogations of mass media as it relates to the consumption of information and entertainment. Over the past 45 years, Birnbaum's work has consistently reclaimed power within and against dominant media paradigms that control access to information and transmit encoded ideologies. The exhibit begins on two floors of the gallery and expands on September 23rd with the premiere of a newly commissioned work spanning the third floor. The Miller Institute for Contemporary Art is located in the Parnell Center on the CMU campus. More information can be found at miller-ica.cmu.edu. Let's see here. Thomas Merton Center 50th Anniversary Celebration. The Thomas Merton Center is a Pittsburgh-related nonprofit organization that works towards ending poverty, war, and discrimination. On Saturday, September 3rd, the Thomas Merton Center will be hosting the Love and Living Music Festival to celebrate their 50th anniversary. The event will be free and welcome for all ages. The event will be held on September 3rd from noon to 6 p.m. at the corner of North Avenue and Cedar Avenue in Allegheny Commons Park on the north side. More information can be found at thomasmertoncenter.org/TMC50. And shows going on around town. Today is the 28th, and yeah, you've missed all those. Tomorrow, 29th, Preserving Underground has negative 13. Tuesday the 30th, Backyard 8th and Penn has Dr. Alton Merrill Quartet. Stage AE has Hulung. KDS Radio Room has Vic Ruggiero and Chris Murray with Shara Ellis and Douglas Lopretto. Roboto Project at 7 has Human Issue with Doc Hammer. Club Cafe at 7:30 has an evening with Tom Brading. Funhouse at Mr. Smalls at 8 has Chris Blake, The Ghost Right, Matt Pless, and Endless Mike. Mr. Smalls on Tuesday has James Bay with Catelyn Tarver. Wednesday, the 31st, Spirit Hall has The Best with Rosie Tucker. Craft House has Blacktop Mojo with Scarlight Sky. And Read One More Night, the 1st of September, Roboto Project has California Cousins, Ultra Deluxe, Not Your Friends, and Morning Dew. Craft House has Tyler Braden. Carnegie of Homestead Music Hall has Matthew Nathanson. Club Cafe has Miriam Grendron. Gendron with Liam Kars, and Thunderbird at 8 has Albert Cummings. If you represent a Pittsburgh-related musician, band, or venue and like us to list your event in our music calendar, please send an email with all the details to music-calendar@wrct.org. All right, I'm going to get right into the music now. Got lots of new stuff. Be on till 9.
Mysteries, catalysts, destruction, frantic instincts, fear through.